Hey, sweetie.
I pull it to
you. Oh, no.
You know, that's what it is. It's basketball. It's not a soft sport.
I'm going to be a man, and if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. This man just gave me a job. I'm not signing that shit.
There's a lot I got to say, but I ain't going to do it here because it's free today. I ain't going to curse.
Hello, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. This is episode 148 of the podcast. Holy moly. My guest this week, or this episode, is Andrew Gaze. You may have heard of him. Tigers, Boomers, Spurs, take your pick. We spoke about comedy, music, the new Andrew Gaze shoe that's coming out, working on his and his father's books, and by that I mean namely Basketball the Andrew Gaze Way, A Kid, A Ball, A Dream by Grantley Bernard, and the most recent one, Gaze, which is about Lindsay, which is also written by Grantley Bernard. I believe it's available by sponsor of the show, Booktopia, and if it is, I've popped the link in the description. Furthermore, we spoke about his friendship with his polar opposite, Shane Heal, and as a broader concept, we talked about sympathy, empathy, aesthetics, being a gentleman, and how that factored into his career and how it factors into leadership as it pertains to the Michael Jordan scale, the Last Dance scale of killer instinct, if that makes sense. I posed the question to Andrew, should Ricky Grace have played more in 2000? Also, does Jonah Bolden carry a scarlet letter with him for leaving the Boomers? And we also talked about Andrew Bogut's near departure from the 04 Athens team and how that doesn't seem to carry quite the same sting as Bolden's departure. I guess because Bogut never left, but we'll talk about that some more. Also, there's a nickname for Gaze out there that you may not know about, and we talk about that. Oh, and of course, spoke about it before, we talk about Andrew Bogut, his time with the Kings, his career, and of course, his recent retirement. In this chat, we talk about Boddy Nodge, friend of the program, and his Hall of Fame candidacy. Boddy is not, I repeat, not N-O-T in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And I think that needs to change. So I'm planning on mobilizing a little effort to make that happen. Not quite sure what form it'll take. I've got the handle of the spear, just not the spearhead. But I thought, why not do this? If you're keen to assist with that venture, with a signature or your time, or you know, just as one of the gang, drop me a line via Twitter at NBLPocketPod or on Facebook or Instagram, NBLPocketPodcast, or email me, NBLPocketPodcast@gmail.com. Last thing, and then I'll F off. I'm selling brand new, pristine copies of Boddy Nodge's book, Marvelous, autographed by Brett Maher himself. I'm selling them on eBay for 25 quid. Links in the description. They retailed at 40. It's a great book. Brett Maher's is a story you're going to want to read. He rose up from the dirt. His father wasn't a pro sportsman or a professional in the sport, which is all too common then and now. He was an original. He is an original. I don't want to say that his story is one of nice guys finish last, because he certainly finished anywhere from last, far from last. But Maher didn't have the opportunities afforded to those born in Melbourne. If he had have had those opportunities, he'd be on the poster of Australian sport. Forget just basketball, but sport. He'd be one of the greats. He was a great player, and his personality and his charm is off the charts. If you're an NBL nut and haven't read this book, I want to say shame on you, but maybe you just didn't have the chance to get a copy, but now's your chance. This thing is practically the only handbook on the NBL out there. It doesn't just cover Maher's career. It covers the beginning of the league, Boddy's work, and then dotted through it is Brett Maher and how he relates to that. So if you're an NBL fan but not a Brett Maher fan or not from Adelaide, it still has great resonance. And if you've ever looked at the NBL in its heyday of the 90s and perhaps you missed it or perhaps you weren't paying attention, it covers that great period in time. And that's just a great period in time to sit in those early 90s when fashion wasn't such a great concern. If you're a lukewarm NBL fan, this book is more than basketball or the NBL or even sports. It's about relationships, love and loss. Not in equal parts comedic and tragic. It's a lot funnier than it is sad. But when it dabbles in both, it does it really, really well. The link to buy the book off eBay is in the description. It's coming from me. I've already sold a few copies. I've worked out all the kinks and it's ready to go. I've said enough. Let's jump into this conversation with the one and only Andrew Gaze. Andrew, I got a compliment for you. You're a very comical guy.
Very funny. I always enjoy your commentary, especially with Homicide. I don't know what it is, but you two have a nice little synergy.
No, he's a fun man.
You've got a good timing. And I want to know, do you have a favorite comedian who you either try and emulate or who one who you find yourself kind of falling in the mood of?
Gee, you've started off on a question, and I've had many questions thrown at me my entire life. And I dare say, I don't know if I've ever been asked that question before. But no, I enjoy comedy. I like to go and watch comedy, or I watch comedy on television a lot. But I kind of enjoyed, when I was growing up, more the speakers that could speak with humor and get a message across with humor. And I think my dad was always like that as well. So I suppose that was ingrained in me through those formative years. Right. And you just have an appreciation of what you're comfortable with and what you like. But I really enjoy comedy, and it's becoming really difficult these days, I think, for comedians because of the world we live in.
Yeah.
But hopefully it's for the better in the long run.
Because, I mean, to me, you strike – the one I would have said is Jamoan. If I had to pick your comedy comp, it would be Jamoan.
Yeah, he's not. He's kind good.
Like funny in conversation, like you said, but then like rubbery, malleable, you know? Like you've got, so that would be my comp.
Well, that's a compliment. And the thing about Jamoan, I love the accent too.
Yeah,
so
sure.
That he can make pretty basic stuff sound pretty funny. So,
and Colin Hay, when you talk about just telling a story and being funny along the way, almost by accident, Colin Hay is a guy, musician by trade, but who tells funny stories.
He's Men at Work, wasn't he? Was he Men at Work?
Yeah. He's got his own solo stuff now, and he sort of plays a little bit, and then he'll tell stories, and they're the funniest stuff you'll hear. But anyway.
Yeah. No, they're the best ones. They're probably more natural, and I've done a lot of public speaking throughout my time as well with public speaking engagements. And I think that the funniest stuff is the real stuff. Yeah, and of course we all put some mayo on it and we all exaggerate here and there, but when it's based on something that is legitimate, that's when it's genuinely funny.
I like that. Legit. Let's talk about the shoes. Shoes have come out.
Oh yes.
They've come out in the past. What's the same? What's different?
I think this time the quality is a lot different, in that last time we did it and we were really, really successful, but we did it, or I did it along with Nigel Purchase and Paul Maley, another guy. We had a bit of a partnership and we worked together. And what we did last time, and this is early to mid 2000s, we licensed it out to Pac Brands with Dunlop, and you forego a lot of the control over the actual products. And we're in a space where really, really price sensitive.
Yeah.
And in order to get the margins that you need to survive, I think last time when we did it, the quality perhaps was good. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
it was good, but it was not the same level as what we've been able to do more recently, because we're doing it ourselves. And it's interesting because I'm involved, and a lot of people think, well, this is a entrepreneurial exercise, which it is, don't get me wrong, but I'm certainly not going to be feeding my family. And when you're in the space that we're trying to play in, it's a volume business, it's very low margin, and in particular for myself and a guy that's helping me out with it, who I partnered with, it's more altruistic. It's more wanting to give back. It's more seeing the challenges that are out there and trying to put a product out there that is more affordable. And that is difficult. Yeah. But I'm really, really excited about the shoes that are going in, or they're probably in almost as we speak in Big W.
Yep.
But I'm so hopeful and praying that we have success with them, because like anything, we've got our next range ready to go.
Right.
And it is, I saw it and I was blown away by the improvement in quality, but also in design. So it's one that I feel good about myself for doing it. My wife doesn't feel good about it because it's a lot of work and a lot of time and not a lot of reward, but the reward is more than just a financial reward. It's a reward of seeing something and producing something, and hopefully from little things, big things grow.
That's Paul Kelly. The shoe, I remember the last time it sort of had a bluish hue, and or the one I had anyway had a sort of sweet, like a sail on it that was blue. The ones I've seen now kind of have this sort of webbing on it, or like a, sort of like a spider web design on it. I've seen the all white one.
Yeah, that's the only one we've released publicly. Okay. And it's and legitimately, we only made 100 pairs, and it was us just wanting to do something a little bit exclusive. And as such, when you only make 100 pairs, it costs a hell of a lot more than when you make 15,000 pairs. Sure. So it was a little project. Again, we don't make much. In fact, I'm not. We might actually lose money on that one.
Tell me, Andrew.
It was inspired. Those markings on the back. And maybe I'm drawing on my very, very limited artistic view, but it was more inspired with a bit of a tiger theme, you know, with the
tigers. Sort of stripe and the way it mats together.
That type of stuff. So I don't know if we were successful with it, but it's we take inspiration from a lot of other people and try to come up with our own little flavor.
Do you think it'll be as big as? Do you think it'll be as big a moneymaker? And do you think it'll have the level of craftsmanship as this bad boy I picked up one time? This is an Andrew Gaze.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, wow.
That's where production really hurts you. When you're trying to get a likeness and you're doing a bobblehead and you've got a head the size that I have, I mean, the materials,
The
balance between the input into the materials, the cost of production, and the retail price, I'm not so sure they made a profit out of that one.
I will say the amount of movement is pretty fair because you move around a lot. This thing moves around a lot. You know, that's where it's good, like for like. Andrew, you retired 15 years ago.
Jeez. Doesn't seem like that long ago.
You've just released the Gaze shoe. Was there any thought to releasing a Gaze slipper?
The slipper. We're happy to...
That would sell.
Diversify in other categories, but what we have got in our offering that we're presenting to our partner, which is Big W, we've got the little slip on. You know, like games, you see
shoe.
The little. It's not a slipper, so I'm not sort of going for that level of demographic, but it's still a very functional slipper. I don't know whether they're going to. Except that we're always bombarding them with all these different ideas, and our percentages aren't great when we're pitching stuff.
Same percentages as this show, I'd say. Yeah,
we're about 1 of 15, 1 of 16, and we just need this one to have just a small modicum of success. So hopefully, we can get a few others in there.
A friend of mine and co-host of the show, Andrew Canyon, he wanted me to personally thank you for your book, Basketball, The Andrew Gaze Way. He really enjoyed that book. Even further
back
now.
The one with the caricatures.
How to shoot.
That would have been early 90s.
Yeah, 20, 30 years ago. Yeah. So
what happened was with that one was I was doing a every 2 weeks, The Age newspaper. And Patrick Smith was the editor there. He had me do these little tips to try and educate people on basketball. And we did these little drawings. And then after we'd done about 20 or 30 of them, they came and said, well, why don't we put them all in a book? And I said, sounds like a good idea to me. And we whacked it into a book. If you go through it with a fine tooth comb, there's a few noticeable glitches, I'd like to call it.
Like what?
Yeah, there is some. Oh, I don't want to reveal them.
I'll have to go back through it.
Some of the names that we might have just back in those days, they're handwritten, might have not translated. Perhaps I didn't do enough vetting they were there. So there are a few little glitches in there, but nothing that compromises the foundation and the fundamentals of the book.
He had a second question for you when I said I was chatting to you. He said, you and Shane Heal are seemingly so polar opposites in character. Yet you're seemingly such good friends. I mean, you would never give the finger to an entire crowd, Andrew. I don't think anyway. No. What maintains the friendship?
We've been friends for a long time. We're roommates throughout our time with the Boomers. And you're right. We were somewhat opposites. But I think, and I go back to my own career, I remember Phil Smythe and Steve Breeny. To me, they were polar opposites.
Yeah.
But lifelong friends and spent a lot of time together and have a bond that's really unbreakable. With Shane and I, we are different, but there are still a lot of common denominators between us both. And I think that we're both highly driven, highly motivated. And it's the old, was it the either ego and super ego? I'm going back to my university days, by Freud, days of psychology. Whereas I think that there are a lot of similarities.
It's not psychology of penis envy, is it, Andrew?
but he probably expresses it in a more overt way, and yeah, I'm able to perhaps contain it a little bit more. But you know, we are similar in many ways, but different in others. And I think that we enjoy each other's company, and we don't always agree. And I think that's some of the fun of it. You don't always agree, but on the court, he was great to play with, very creative. Shane, I think, is underrated as a point guard because he was such a prolific scorer and an unbelievable shooter that I think a lot of people overlook his point guard abilities, the way in which he can distribute the ball. And during our time with the Boomers, he made me look better than probably what I was a lot of the time through his skills. So you're always good. And I told my son this when he's gone over to play college basketball. The first thing you do is you go find out who the point guard is of their team. You shake their hand and you become their best friend because they are going to be very, very important.
I think there's a chapter on that in the basketball, the Andrew Gaze way. It was a character.
It might have been. But no, I've, you know, great, good friends with Hammer. I enjoy his company and he's, like I said, we don't always agree on things, but I think we have mutual respect.
I think the other thing with him is jumped around a bit. You know, you played obviously all the time with the Tigers and he kind of went from, you know, Geelong to Sydney and, you know, back again. So and that makes it difficult, especially in the NBL when you're not, you know, you're not a one or two club kind of guy or a long stay at a club can be a bit interesting. I want to talk about your book with Grantley Bernard. We spoke about it a little bit before. Kid, a Ball, a Dream. Yep. What was your process from working on that book? Did you actually write chapters and then refer it to him or did you sit down with Grantley and just, you know, have a long chat and record it on recorder? How did that book come
We did all of that. A lot of it was done was sitting down and just talking to Grantley and he'd record it and he'd transcribe it. And then it'd come back to me and then, you know, I'd edit it, put my little spin on it. Don't like this, like this. And we just figured it out that way. So all of the above. And it was a long process and we're under time constraints because I just retired and they wanted to get it out as soon as they possibly could. Yeah. And, Grantley's a good friend of mine. I got to know him really, really well over the years. I'm not sure if you've mentioned already, it might've been before you pressed record, but he's also been involved
the Gaze
with
book,
my dad's
Lindsay's book.
Yeah. I got a book coming out now. So he's a good friend of the family. He's a good fella and he writes really well. He's presented the ideas,
logically, trying
to understand perhaps the somewhat conservative nature that I had and my dad had, but still trying to make it interesting, which is not always easy.
Right. In Matt Logue's book that recently came out, Hoop Dreams Down Under, Shane Heal says that the band Dire Straight was the music he would listen to on a boombox when warming up training and things like that.
Yeah. Yep.
My question to you, Andrew, is what music did you listen to get hyped before games? And what band would you give as the soundtrack of your career? Like, you know how we just watched The Last Dance and Pearl Jam was kind of
cool.
What did you used to listen to get hyped? What would be the soundtrack to your career, do you think?
Well, it varied throughout the course of my career, but I go back to those days when I was just coming into senior basketball and in particular breaking into the Australian team. And I was probably what is regarded as classic rock. I was Journey. I was ELO. I was AC/DC. Those types of sort of, I don't know, back then they were real electrical guitar, that type of stuff to crank it up. But as I went through, I morphed into something that you probably hate, more a pop guy.
Really?
You know, okay. like pop music. Yeah, you know, I had a good Australian flavor. I like Johnny Farnham, my Little River Band. They were great back in the day. And even when Johnny Farnham was with Little River Band, I liked Moving Pictures. I liked Cold Chisel. I liked Kids in the Kitchen. Those Australian bands are the ones I can remember throughout those formative years. But as I got older, I got more into the R&B. Really? I love Luther Vandross. You know who introduced me and got me started on the R&B way was Cal Bruton.
Oh, sure.
Cal Bruton Sr. Would have been 1985, 1986, around there. I was rooming with him when he was part of the Australian team a bit. And, yeah, he pointed me in that direction. And I remember we were in New Zealand one time and we went into a record store and I bought a cassette of Luther Vandross.
Jeez.
Played it on the Sony Walkman. And, he got me down that track. And I'm not great with remembering a lot of the names of the bands, but I like to recall the songs and they bring back great memories.
You got a couple of nicknames out there. Gazy, Drury, we all know you by those nicknames. Magic Johnson was known as Buck to his teammates. Why, I don't know. Not Irving, not Magic, but Buck. Did teammates have a nickname for you beyond the obvious?
When I was there, and this is cringeworthy stuff because it sounds like I'm being a bit self-indulgent here.
Let's hear it.
But I remember...
I'm all for that sort of thing.
I remember with the Australian team in particular... and this was Damien Keogh and Luke Longley. Still, whenever I call up Luke, he refers to the nickname. He used to call me the Factor. And I really enjoy the nickname, but I don't really talk about it too much because you feel like a bit of a wanker.
Any nickname that starts with the, you know, the something, it's like it's a bit grandiose. But yeah, let's hear it. The Factor.
And if I call up Luke, hey Factor, what's going on? And he's probably one of the few, him and Damien Keogh, are the ones that probably refer to it the most. But it was, it's nice. And I remember when I was with the Spurs one time and we were playing Phoenix. And, well, when I say playing, I was there, you know, waving the tail and clapping and being a part of it. We played Phoenix.
You got paid. That's amazing.
Yeah, and we went into a shoot-around and Luke was there and Phoenix was just finishing. And Luke came, hey, Factor, what's going on? And I think it was Rex Chapman. He goes, Factor. He goes, that's the greatest nickname I've ever heard in my life. And I felt really embarrassed because the Factor was 15th man on a 15th man roster sitting at the end of the bench waving a towel. But it was nice. It was nice. It's a nice nickname. And I've been called a lot worse, put it that way.
I want to talk, going back to Kid a Ball Dream. I want to go back to that. In that book, a very specific part of it, in the Seton Hall, you talk about how, I think it's the Final Four, a guy is at the foul line. I can hear your phone going off.
He's at the line,
and you say you had great sympathy for him. You write in the book.
I did.
Yeah. We've just come off The Last Dance, in which Jordan, you know, the cutthroatness, he wouldn't have felt that way, I'm sure. Take no prisoners. You know, did you have that killer instinct? You know, were you hard on teammates like that way? And do you need to be that way to succeed in sports and to be specific?
Well, I think with all those things, there's a balance somewhere in there. And I don't think you need to be unsportsmanlike or I don't think you need to have disrespect for the game in order to be successful. I think you don't have to break it to make it.
Sort of thing.
Correct. I think that we saw... extremes with Michael Jordan with his determination, but I don't think you can relate that to not having great respect for the game or respect for his teammates. It's just the way in which he communicated with them. And there's a lot of different leadership styles. In fact, I dare say based on my understanding of the limited time I've coached in the senior level and certainly coaching in the junior level, I'm not so sure that that particular style could work in
anymore
with the personalities that are there today. It might, but you would need to be of that LeBron James or Michael Jordan ilk in order to get away with it, because it's confronting. And I think that it doesn't always get the best out of your teammates. Now, it certainly did, and you look at the record and six NBA titles suggest that it was a very successful way to lead. But I'm not sure that it's exclusively related to that. I think there are many other variables that go into it. And I think that you can, and my style is not everyone's cup of tea, as you learn, but there's no one size fits all. There's always going to be conflict. You go back into some of the greatest teams that have ever been and ever lived, and some of the greatest coaches, I guarantee you can always find someone that say, well, I respect this guy, but it's not necessarily the style, or don't always get everyone buying in. And that's just the nature of the game. And I have great faith in the education that I have and the way the game has can be played, and how it can be both rewarding for the players and the fans. And the aesthetic of the game is just as important as the actual game, because without a great aesthetic of the game, it's probably going to be a pretty lonely type situation. So all those things come into the consideration when I'm involved in the game. And that's not for everyone. And because some people have a different view, and that's fair enough. It's not, there's no right or wrong. It's just about trying to get people to buy in and believe in your own values and your own idea on how you're going to get the best out of individuals. And sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And you've kind of already answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway. You won 7 MVPs, 5 in a row, if I'm right, 2 titles. Is there ever a part of you that thinks, if I'd been more like turn the screws, it would have been closer to, 7 MVPs and 5 titles? Or, do you think, is there any part of you that's like, oh, I could have turned the screws more?
Well, if you ask my teammates, I think that they would probably think that I maybe turned the screws too much.
Oh, really?
I've had
Brett Rainbow on here before.
Yeah.
He said one time you chewed him up, but no, and he said that in the way that's supposed to happen.
Yeah, and sometimes I remember some interactions with one individual who will remain nameless that I think forever and a day, it's because of the way in which that advice was provided. We get along really well. There's no problems, right. But I think it tarnishes his view of me because of the expectations. And it had an impact on me because, we all like to be liked. Yeah. And I can certainly understand it when people don't like me because I'm a pain in the ass, but it upsets me that people think that your motives were more selfish, or that your motives weren't in the team's best interest. So I think that a lot of people internally would look back and say that, maybe I was too driven.
Do you think people
maybe I did push myself a little too hard, and I had expectations that on others that may have been unrealistic?
Right. Yeah. Changing tact. Body Nodge, friend of the show, comes on all the time. Great guy.
He's a good man.
I don't suppose you've read his book, Marvelous, about Brett Maher, but it's also a bit of a handbook about the NBA. Have you read that one?
I have not. No.
It's a good one. When you've got the chance, I want to ask you this question. This might be a bit. Do you think Boddy should be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, Boddy has made an unbelievable contribution to the game. He's got a book coming out, and I spoke to him recently about the book. And he is an amazing historian of the game. He can be polarizing because of the way he writes. He's a really intelligent, thoughtful writer that can say things in a hurtful but logical way,
and sometimes comical, maybe, and
very comical. He can be very, very funny.
Yeah.
I think that he is a brilliant journalist, and he's a good man, a very good man that has a unbelievable passion for the game, and I've got great respect for him. Now, I haven't always agreed with his view and his assessment, but there is an element of how you interpret certain things. But I would have a different interpretation than what he does. But that doesn't mean that I'm right and he's wrong, or he's right and I'm wrong. That you can just have a different interpretation of things that took place. The context that around it can be different for each individual, and as such, we're different. But he has been an unbelievable contributor to the game. He's tirelessly and passionately devoted himself to the sport. And for over 40 years, he was writing about this game and promoting this game. So if I had a vote, I don't know the criteria for Hall of Fames, but there needs, if there's not a category that he doesn't fit in, there needs to be one created, because he has made an enormous contribution to the game. And when it comes to South Australian basketball, no one knows more.
Yeah, unapologetic.
Now, he might interpret it differently, but no one knows more or has been a part of it and has knowledge of everything that's gone on in South Australia than what he has. And he's very patriotic, which I respect. And he, even on a national scale, has been very influential in the game.
By the way, marvellous. I've got signed copies if you, and I'm selling them if you're interested, just by the way. I want to talk to you about the 80s.
New book.
I've got the old one, but the new one's coming up. Okay. Yeah, of the old one.
He sent me, I haven't read him. He sent me a couple of chapters. I've read brief bits of them.
Of the memoir, yeah.
He's another one. He writes really well. He's very funny.
Yeah.
And he puts a perspective on it that's engaging. So when his book comes out, I would strongly recommend it, because even if you don't know a lot about basketball, the way in which he writes, he's a tremendous historian of the game, but presents it in a very interesting way.
Changing subject totally. 1987 is the NBL season. You average 44 points a game.
Yeah.
You're how old at that time? 21, I think.
Yeah. Well, I was turning 22, but
22.
Born 65.
Right. Homicide and Hammer often go back and forth on Twitter about James Harden. I think Hammer thinks he's a bit selfish. Homicide defends him. That season, 44, you go. The Tigers go 3 wins, 23 losses. How'd you get to 44? Like, at times were you in the games going, this is crazy, I'm shooting every time, I'm scoring every time, or did you come away from that? Yeah, how'd you get to 44?
I don't really talk about that too much, because it's a great statistic and it looks really, really impressive on the resume, but it's not a season that I have really fond memories of. It was a hard season. We lost imports halfway through. We played with no imports. We had a lot of challenge. We were rank amateurs and we're getting our ass kicked. And when you're competitive, and regardless of your individual performance, sure, you can get some when you feel like you've played well and done your best. You can come away and you put the head on the pillow and go, well, I tried my hardest, it just wasn't good enough. But you still, there's that sense of failure because you're not winning. So I don't look back on that season with any great pride. It's fantastic that others, and I do, and perhaps I need to pull them up like I am with you here a little bit more, but it's fantastic that people see it as an incredible achievement. And I'm not trying to undersell the individual, you know, and be this show humility beyond reason, but it's a season that doesn't resonate with me a lot. And it was one that it was a lot of meaningless points in some games where you're just out there trying to do your best. I think that it was good for me individually. So selfishly, it helped. You generate confidence from that. It helps with your profile and other elements of trying to carve a career in the sport. But it's not one that I look back on as one of the more memorable seasons.
Yeah, right. Were you catching it and shooting it every time? Like, were the plays designed?
No,
not really.
No,
just happened.
If you look at the percentages are really high, because it was a lot of layups. You know, yeah, it was
backdoor
about
cuts. Playing, I know, I remember
playing with Nigel Purchase and the way in which he was able to deliver the ball. And when you don't have a lot of other scoring options on your team, and you've the other guys on the team understand that they're probably not great at scoring options themselves, and the way in which they are providing you access to opportunities that you need, obviously you need skill to be able to make the most of it, but they make it a whole lot easier when it's all going through you and you've got the ball in your hands a lot. So it was, it wasn't one that, and clearly you got to take a lot of shots in order to average 44, but it wasn't one where you're coming out there and you're going six Blaze. For 27.
You didn't see any similarity between the way you played that season and how Harden plays today, for example?
Not in the slightest, because most of my work was done off the ball.
Back cuts. And
so it was movement away from the ball, whereas his is more with the ball. I would probably lean towards Shane Heal's view that I have unbelievable respect for what James Harden can do. He is one of the great players of this era, and he's incredibly skilled. But again, going back to what I said before about the aesthetics of the game and how your values and your philosophy on the game, watching him play doesn't excite me. It's not one that if I've got a choice of who to watch.
Right.
There are many other players that I'm going to, when I go to NBA League Pass and you're watching every game, that I'm going to go to other games before I go to one of his games.
I'm really fascinated and also almost envious of your relationship with your father. You know, you two basically had a family business within professional sports. I mean, that may never happen again. I mean, that was just so rare. It was born of the time, but it was also born of you too. I think you forged that too for yourself. And I look at this, like, let's say Chris Golding, for example. He's played on 5 different NBL teams, presumably for 6 coaches. If you just go on the NBA, NBL, presumably 6 or 7 different offensive structures and boom. You had one coach, one team, one system, the shuffle. Was it a hindrance, like we talked about killer instinct before? Was it ever a hindrance having your father involved? Like we talked about that before. Like, was your comfort zone too enticing? So when you went to the NBA, because you kind of write about it in your book, was it too enticing to return to that really strong relationship you had with Lindsay?
I don't think so. I think that it was one that everyone's craving for, a relationship like that with the coach. Now, yes, he was my dad, but I've said this numerous times, if you could take a hypothetical situation where you got someone that knew nothing about Australian basketball, nothing about the relationships, and you plonk that person in at the start of the season, and they were with the team the whole time, every training session, every game, every timeout, they were there and just observing the whole time. And at the end of the season, you asked that person, which one of those players on the team was the coach's son? My view, and I don't know whether my teammates would agree with this, but my view is there would be some difficulty in identifying exactly who that person is, because my father's approach, a very egalitarian approach to the team, the way in which you treat people. And in his view, every one of his players is his son.
Right.
And he's not a confrontational, in-your-face, screamer style. And he is very pragmatic. He's very much a theory guy. And the relationships that he builds with the players is similar. Now, some, and rightly so, could argue that's unrealistic. You can't do that. But that was the way he did it.
Yeah, right.
And for me, I don't think it inhibited me at all.
Right.
Now, if you ever get the chance to get Leonard Copeland on here, he thinks he was robbed because he was subbed out of games and he was denied at least an extra 10 points a game.
I have heard this, yes.
Because now, I think in honesty that Leonard does that in jest more than anything. But I say that just to provide balance, that there may be others that within the teammates that don't agree with my outlook. But it was never really a problem for me, and I think it was one that I got different coaching experiences. Very brief time with Bernie Bickerstaff at Seattle, playing in Italy, playing in Greece, playing for PJ Carlissimo, playing for Barry Barnes, Adrian Hurley. And if you look at him, it's not as perhaps as many as a lot of the other players, but fortunately, absolute uber elite coaches that I was with. And beyond that, and when I'm asked about my own career and the pathway it took, one of the greatest advantages, when I first started senior basketball, the team that I came into had Brian Gorgian, Alan Westover, Bruce Palmer, Huey Hobus as my teammates, four imports. The import restrictions weren't like they are today back then. Three of them went on to be three of the greatest coaches this country has ever seen. Although they never coached me as such in a team environment, when they're your teammates, they are coaches on the floor and you learn from them as well. So I feel like that I had a really broad experiences learning from a variety of different styles and people and coaching techniques that helped me along the way.
I'll say this, you played minutes, Andrew. You're number one in minutes in the NBL, 24,496. The next is Tony Rollinson on 23,491, 1,000 less, despite he played two more seasons. I asked this question in because Hammer's always like, play these guys more. You know, like he likes, in a 40-minute game, he likes you guys sit around 35. Did you ever see your amount of minutes and go, oh, this is, it's breaking me down. I should play less. I should play more. Where do you sit on that debate?
Never. Always loved to play, wanted to play every minute at every single game. And it was difficult. 48-minute games, a lot of back-to-back games. And I do get a kick out of some of the comments about
the schedule.
Load management.
It had a very different meaning back in the day. Yeah.
Well, that's right. And they'll argue, oh, the game's more athletic. And well, that may be true, but we didn't have the sports science either. We didn't have the recovery sessions. There are pros and cons to both, but again, I'm probably more in the Hammer style, and it also impacts the way you coach. When I coached the Sydney Kings, despite in one game, Shane and others suggesting that maybe I subbed too much, that I think the years that I was there that had less rotations than most other teams, had a core sort of eight guys that playing most of the minutes. And some are critical of that and fair enough. That, like I said, there's no right or wrong way, but that's the way I wanted to play. That's the way I think you get the best out of your talent. And it is difficult for some that don't get the same opportunities as others, but you provide a pathway for them to grow. And if they, and it's competitive internally. And yeah, I never got, went back when I was playing, we were the same. And I think that we recruited the same way as well. If you look at the depth of our team, we had superstars in our team, but probably didn't have the same depth. And maybe when you look back on it, it cost us a championship here or there. Yeah. That maybe if we did have a little bit more depth and we did, have a different process of rotating players and keeping people fresh. Who knows? They're questions you only have in hindsight, but I have no regrets and I enjoyed it. And I think it is difficult for a lot of players these days with some of the coaching rotations. But like I said, that's the beauty of the game. It can be played in a variety of different ways.
You spoke about the Kings, NBL 19 was your last year. You stepped down before the playoffs. I got to ask this one. So I actually went back and watched game two when Melbourne kind of, they'd won that series. Lish comes out of the game, big chat, big hug. Jerome Randall comes out of the game, big chat, big hug. And this is where we go on to Andrew Bogut. When he came out, it was just a little low five. What was it like coaching Andrew Bogut that year? The end of that season in particular, what was it? Was there a friction at all?
Oh, I enjoyed my time coaching the Sydney Kings and are grateful for the experience to have the opportunity to work with Bogues. We didn't always get along. And I think that when I say didn't get along, we had tremendous respect. He showed me great respect. And we had conversations. He was very frank with me.
Right.
In private conversations about how he would like me to, be more forceful in holding people accountable, those types of things. I don't want to go into the minutiae of our relationship, but to say that I did my best to put Bogues in a position where he could be successful. As a team, we weren't. As an individual, I thought that he did really well. Some would say, well, he was going to do well anyway, but he wasn't MVP the year we were there. And I had fun coaching him. I am grateful for the commitment that he gave to me, the way in which he tried to help me. But I get along well with the man. I have no problem with the man. But I understand that we probably differ in the way in which we dealt with some of the issues in the team. And they weren't just X's and O's issues. They were the way in which, as every single team has to deal with, and how that should be handled. So I accept that. I accept that his idea of, as it would be with all of them, Kevin and these other guys as well, Jerome, we all have different ideas of what's the best training routine. How long should you train? How much is individual? How do you develop people's skills individually? How do you develop them in a team environment? All those things we would vary on. But at the end of the day, you have those conversations, and he was a pro. He did the best to buy into what I was trying to do. And I really enjoyed the relationship with him.
We talked about that, like, Jordan mindset. Where does Bogut, now retired and a great career, where does he sit on that scale of, gentleman of the game towards, being desperate to win, killer player?
He's ruthless. Yeah. No, he's ruthless. He's not going to worry about hurting someone's feelings.
No, I get that.
But it comes from a good place.
Yeah.
It comes from a very experienced guy that has a status in the game and a knowledge of the game that deserves respect. So he does it in a way in which, I guess, I never played with Jordan. I don't know anything to do with Jordan, but
he did it.
Based on my understanding of it, he understands and thrives in that type of accountability and the way in which you provide that type of feedback. So, again, I keep repeating myself. I understand it and get it, but it wasn't – I think he was really loved by his teammates, just a ruthlessly competitive guy, and he pushed himself. There are many, many times when we said, Bugs, we're concerned about managing your body. Nah, I want to be out. I can go. And we gave him a lot of latitude because of his body and his age and where he's at. But he wanted to train. He wanted to be out there with the fellas. And I think that he earned a lot of respect, because clearly there are many, many times he was out there pushing through because he was dealing with some ailments that he had every right to take a spell. But he pushed through. I think in hindsight, if I had my time over again, sometimes you got to protect players from themselves. And I always had the attitude, no, well, you make the decision. If you call and there's no – and maybe I should have been a little bit more forceless to say, Bugs, you need a spell, mate.
Yeah.
But I always thought that he knew, and it's one of those ones that I have no regrets, but maybe it might have been more helpful to him and beneficial to him. And you see him making his retirement now, to say, I could have maybe helped him more by just saying, take some more time off, big fella, and demanding he did, because there was clearly times he was not comfortable, but he had this incredible commitment to the team that he wanted to contribute.
I was chatting to a friend of mine, Adam Ryan, who does the In All Fairness podcast, and I think you've been on that show. And he was trying to get in touch with me with Pete Vesey. Do you know Pete Vesey, the American writer, NBA writer?
Yes.
Quite.
I think he was USA Today primarily.
USA Today primarily, yeah. And he had quite a – we talk about Bogut and being – he had a very, pretty curt way about him and real – but I was listening in preparation for maybe talking to him. I was listening to one of his interviews, and he was just mad about Bogut.
just said, oh, you know, this guy's great. He's plays hard. He's really smart. He's really clever. He was so impressed by Bogut. I wonder if you'd chat a little bit about what makes Bogut the best big guy? What makes him better than Longley, do you think, if you think that?
Well, I think that he was more versatile in his skill sets. And I remember Bogut back in those early days when he's with the Australian team and winning medals for the with the Australian junior team. He was inside, outside. He was shooting it. Yeah, he's putting the ball to the deck. I mean, just so versatile. And I think that, and this is not a blight. This is not an insult to Luke by any stretch. But I think that Bogues was a superior athlete than Luke. You know, he had
2004 that Olympics in Athens. Bogut is dunking everything. He is tearing the rim off.
And I think it was 09-10 season. It might have been 10-11, somewhere around that time. But Bogut's averaging 17 or 18, yeah, 11 or 12 boards.
09-10, yeah. He's NBL, I mean, he's NBA third team, yeah.
And that was sort of must-watch television. We didn't see it as much as I watch it now. But I remember back then just watching it going, and the way he did it, his basketball IQ is extraordinary. Luke was the perfect player in a system where his skills were absolutely compatible with what was required. They're both similar in the elite passes. Luke was a fantastic distributor of the ball. Bogues a little bit more mobile, and Bogues a bit around the rim, a bit better rim protection, but we're not talking a lot. You know, Luke was really, really good in that area as well. They're different players. You know, that Bogues could put it to the floor, go behind his back and handle the ball, do some extraordinary things. Both of them are fantastic Australian players and really incredible contribution to the game, both of them. But Bogues, I think, just had a greater versatility to his game.
Yeah, right. I want to jump around a bit because you mentioned the Boomers there. Let's go to 2000. Do you, like I, feel like Ricky Grace was underplayed? I remember thinking that tournament, I just thought Ricky Grace at that time, he was right in his pocket where he was finding guys. He was just turned 30 or 31. I remember watching him in those games and he didn't quite get enough time. Do you agree with that, my thinking there, or what do you think?
Yeah, it's really hard because Shane was a very dominant player and you're saying, well, if Ricky plays, who don't you want to play? Who plays less? So it's all very good and well to say, well, this guy should play, but then you've got to say, well, who doesn't play? Yeah. And how that figures in the balance of things. And extending beyond that, Brett Maher didn't play at all.
Yeah, good point.
And you look at his career and say, well, yeah, he's worthy. But that's the reality of the when you've got these elite teams and you bring them together, some really, really good players don't get to play. Yeah. So it's a difficult one. I think in hindsight, you can always go back and second guess yourself and what ifs. But the what ifs and the hypotheticals that you come up with, you see them in what positively could happen, and you don't always look at, well, there is potentially a negative to that as well.
Yeah, right.
Now, Ricky is a superstar, and it was a pleasure to play alongside him. And yes, he deserved to play more, but I think it's unfair just to say, well, Ricky plays more. You've got to also come back. If that's your argument, you've got to tell me, well, who plays less, and that's going to be a harder decision. That's going to be a harder
sell.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, right. I had Ian Thompson on this podcast recently. He wrote a book called The Soul of Basketball. It was about LeBron's decision and how the sort of NBA played out those years when its best player, with the NBA's best and greatest, was a villain for that time when LeBron went to Miami. And he sort of had this. He was critical of the cynical opinion of the NBA that the league needed a lone superstar in the way that it had Jordan. You know, when the NBA was supreme, it was Jordan. It all went through him. Do you feel like the height of the NBL, do you feel like it mirrored with you? I mean, the height of the NBL was with your career. Do you feel like it went up with you, and do you feel like it did the opposite?
Well, I think it did, but I think that's more coincidence than necessarily a result of me personally. I think that I was lucky to be coming through in that period of time. I am really grateful that people think that I had that type of influence on the game. And I get a great thrill out of it. And sure, my involvement, I no doubt contributed, but I think it's overstated. I think that the influence of American sports, Michael Jordan, and I was part of being carried along with that here in Australia. And very fortunate to be in some profile situations, playing college basketball at Seton Hall, getting through to a championship game, and those two games being semi-final and final being broadcast here direct live into Australia. Now, if we don't make those finals and that doesn't happen, then my profile is probably not the same during that period of time. Yeah, so, right. There is that correlation that you can draw, but to suggest that I had anywhere near the same level of impact that Jordan had, relatively speaking, Australian basketball is fanciful. I came through with some guys that contributed just as much, guys like Phil Smythe and Larry Senstock, Wayne Carroll, Ray Borner, these guys Ian Davies, those guys that I was coming through, incredible contribution, but just didn't have the forum, just didn't have the attention. But without that foundation that those guys built, then the next generation, myself, and others that I came through, we would have been in that same situation if they hadn't built what they had built, and if the people before them hadn't built what they had built. So it's this big ongoing contribution that you make. I treat it as a huge compliment, but I'm also perhaps realistic and smart enough to know that maybe it'd be slightly overstated.
Andrew Bogut's retired. He was sort of the prism through which I feel like the Australian audience watched the NBL, right? He brought interest, people, whether they liked him
or
disliked him.
The NBA or the NBL?
The NBL.
The NBL, the last 2 years.
The last 2 years. He was the prism. He was on billboards. He made the league very digestible. Like, oh, he's on the boomers. He's a big player. We understand how this works. I think the general public who don't know basketball saw it that way.
Yeah.
He's retired now. What happens with the NBL? My question to you, Andrew, is how do the Australian public, who may not be so efficient, super fans are going to be there regardless, but how does the general Australian public watch and consume NBL basketball going forward?
Well, I think what he does is he brings the audience to the game. The people see the game they appreciate that it's bigger than the individual. Their enjoyment of the game is not exclusive to an individual player, but that player is very important about bringing exposure and bringing people to the game. And now when you look at the players that are being imported into our league, the imports that are coming in, the standard of the Australian players, the overall athleticism and standard of the competition, it's important to have those types of people to expose the audience to the overall standard, because then you have a much stronger chance of retaining them. Yeah. And I think that his influence and the people that he and even more recently with a guy like LaMelo Ball brings to the game. Who's this LaMelo Ball kid? Let's go and watch and go there and say, oh shit, LaMelo mightn't have done much, but how good was this? How good a game is this? And they bring that exposure to the game. So they, guys like Bogues, are absolutely pivotal to growing the game. And as why that the investment that the clubs and the league make and providing an environment where these guys want to come back is so critical, because once you get those people to the game, ultimately the product has to be good enough to sustain it. And if you're just going on the whim of one particular player that in a fleeting moment comes and plays, and the game is not, the foundation of the game is not in a situation that can retain them, then it's a fleeting moment, it's a sugar hit, and it doesn't really last. I think there are other sports in Australia that may have gone through that. Yeah. They've had their sugar hits, and you go, how good is this? But has it been sustainable? Well, the evidence would say that perhaps not. So we are fortunate that the quality of the Australian talent, the quality of the imports that's being brought into this league makes it a very, very sustainable product for people to consume and enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, because I would argue that as much as we say, I don't like that cynical view that it's one guy, and I don't hold that view, but I look at someone like Bryce Cotton and I go, gee, if you buy a ticket to Bryce Cotton and watch him play, you're never disappointed. Even when he may have a 30, he may have a 20, may have less than 10. It's not often, but
yeah.
I feel like he is a guy more so than any time that you can just put your money on. And he's going to be fun. He's going to be great. I mean, he to me is, he's spectacular. And I think I'm hoping that Australia can embrace an import. Well, he's an import. I mean, for how much longer there's talk that he's going to become an Australian citizen. But I feel like he's the guy who's going to be, who needs to be at the front of every billboard because he's just
correct. And it's one that, Bogues, to his credit, had choices of where he could go. But there is there's a desire. He's Australia. He loves his country and he wants to live here and bring his family up and those types of things. But purely from a financial standpoint, he could have gone and played anywhere in the world.
Yeah, right.
But he had this sense of obligation to say, hey, Australia's given me a lot. I need to give back. And that's something that sort of goes a little or pushed to the side a little bit that we, he gets a lot of accolades, which he deserves. But that's, to me, one of the biggest thing is just the mere fact that he wants to come back. And when you think of these guys that we've got in the NBA, how great is he going to be with Patty Mills or Joe Ingles or Matthew Dellavedova? We've got these string of guys, and who knows, maybe in 10, 15 years' time, Ben Simmons, these guys that have played in the NBA, developed these incredible reputations. And I wouldn't condemn them if they don't do it because of their body and for other reasons, but when they do it, it has a profound impact on our game because it brings exposure to the game to a whole bunch more people.
Yeah, perfect. Andrew, I'm going to ask this question. I might cut it out because I don't know. I want to talk about Jonah Bolden. It's a negative one to end on, which I don't like, but obviously walked away came away from the Boomers in that time. I mean, I remember in 04, we're talking about Bogut. He had that similar thing where in 04, he kind of had a blow up with Gorgian. Was going to leave the village, had to be talked out of it. It's in Boddy's book at some point.
Yeah.
Is it such a bad thing? And Bogut's now was the face of the Boomers, whereas Bolden seems to carry this little bit of a scarlet letter with him. Do you think it's fair? Where does that go forward? Because he's a player I look at and go, well, he needs to certainly be in consideration for the Boomers or maybe, selection. Where do you sit on that?
Well, I think that sometimes an individual's desire to contribute and perform and the role that they want doesn't always meet with the role that others are providing them. And it can lead to disappointment. And I think one of the great things about Bogues and everything that I've heard him talk about, that he reflects, whether it's there or whether it's college, he reflects on some of the things that he's done in the past. And he said, well, I learned from that.
Yeah.
And that I think that he would, he has, I believe, conceded that some of the things that he might have done that he would do differently.
Yeah, he's good about that.
I don't think
too proud for anything. He's good like that. Yeah.
No, and I think that the same hopefully will apply with Jonah, because I think in that quest and this anxiety about your career and how your contribution to the national team can impact that career.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes the emotions can get the better of you and you can make decisions at the heat of the moment with not a great depth of experience that you live to regret.
Yeah.
And I think that from Jonah Bolden's standpoint and based on the information that I had, that he did not handle that situation that in 10 years' time he'll look back on and say that I wouldn't like to change.
Yeah, because
now I don't Bogut, know that.
Yeah, right. Because I in Boddy's book, Bogut talks about you had a thing on the court with Gorgian. Storms like he's going to leave the village. This is when the NBA draft is coming. It's a tough time for him,
correct. I'm sure.
And then, but later apologized, took the floor, So it is correct. A different situation, but I understand what
you mean. It is very difficult and it's the way of the world right now. You look at some of the behavior of NBA players.
It's a bubble. It's so different.
It's that business element to it and how some players will have that business element to it, I think is not the right way to go about it. I think that, yes, you're a commodity and there is business... elements and brand and all those things, but they will generally take care of themselves.
Right.
And how you think you're going to be tarnished and how you think something's happening is going to impact you isn't always the case. And that's where you're getting the right advice from others that are outside to provide you with some sort of guidance. And what is difficult is when you as an individual feel like there is an injustice going on and you're not getting the opportunity you think you should have, and you've got others around you saying, yeah, they're screwing you. Yeah.
Right.
It's when you've got people around you, give you a tap on the shoulder and say, hang on a second, I feel you. You've got a valid claim. Yes, but let's work our way through this. And how can we still respect the game, respect your teammates, respect your brand? They are very important to have around you, so you have a better chance of making good decisions.
Makes sense. Andrew, you're a gentleman of the game. I appreciate you taking the time for me. Really do. Thank you very much.
No, it's been a pleasure. Good luck. I'll look forward to tuning in and listening to some of your other work. You've mentioned a few.
Body and I did an episode on you. Yes, we did. Yeah.
I have not heard that. I have not heard it.
Well, I'm sure there was some
in between some of the opinions.
I was great. I love chatting to you about, you know,
good stuff. But
for sure.
Yeah, I did not hear it. Perhaps I should have listened to that before I spoke about body, because if you had laid the knives in,
he did not at all.
I could have launched on him.